My name is Gregory Wilson, and I am honored to be here. And just in the brief introductory remarks, I realize that I have been invited not just to talk to students, but I've been invited into a community. And I am appreciative of that and aware of that, and I think that community is going to be an issue when we talk about tolerance and intolerance, especially in terms of religion, whether communities are open or communities are closed. So I think that's going to be important. I do come to you today as a religious person, in a faith tradition, Unitarian Universalism, where we at least claim that we are a tolerant group of people. Our values, we don't, as an organization and as a faith tradition, we don't necessarily organize ourselves, if it's possible, around a set of beliefs or a set of propositions. We more at least like to say publicly that we gather and combine and join together around a set of principles. And that on any given Sunday, I know in the congregation where I am, we could have atheist, agnostic, Christian, Jew, Hindu, Wiccan, pagan, in the same sitting out, say where you're sitting out. And it is we can do that because it is the principles that unite us, not the beliefs. And I thought I would read those principles to give you some idea of our core values, which also gives you an idea of where I'm coming from today. Each Sunday, we repeat this as a group of people, that we gather together to agree and affirm to promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and our society at large, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, respect for the independent web of all existence of which we are a part. And a high value, at least as I like to understand who we are as a people, we have a high value on curiosity. We like curiosity, the questioning process, and the exploring process. And when we think about tolerance or intolerance, I'm going to say today that the human capacity for curiosity exists and flourishes in an attitude of tolerance. I remember asking a friend of mine one time, more conservative fellow, we were having this conversation. I said, as we're having this conversation, can you imagine there would be no hell? Can we have this conversation as if hell does not exist? Right? And his mind could not go there. And I was shocked at first, but then I learned something, that there are some beliefs that we have as people that we can't even imagine not having. That we are so locked into our own belief systems, to imagine not having the belief, we can't figure out how to operate. So I was thinking today what fun it would be to talk about intolerance and tolerance, and how much fun I could have talking about Jerry Falwell, James Dobson and Pat Robertson, and just what I would consider religious intolerance in our culture. Talk about the dominionists and the reconstructionists and how they're infiltrating our political system or taking over our Supreme Court, and what fun that would be in order to do that. And then I thought, and as my supervisors taught me, you must consider who you're talking to and what the people are about that you're talking to before you present your presentation, and consider the other person. And then I thought, well, if I'm going to be talking to graduate students and doctoral students, maybe I ought to consider that. And then after considering that, I thought, well, they can look up dominionist, reconstructionist, these different names on the internet and do that kind of research. What could I do that would be an invitation and a curious thought process to invite you in and engage in a dialogue to explore tolerance and intolerance in general and what it means to be human. So that's what I'm going to attempt to do today, is try to create an environment where we can see the context in which tolerance and intolerance exists. The larger context. And what occurred to me is that, I don't know if you've looked at the work of D.W. Winnicott in Object Relations, where in that thought, the holding environment, the therapeutic container, is kind of the mainstay, is that we understand the therapeutic container and the holding environment in kind of a maternal understanding, where we create a safe enough environment and an environment that's caring enough that people can be at ease with themselves in order to facilitate transformation. But as we are in that holding environment, you bring in with you an understanding of transference, an understanding of countertransference, an understanding of family systems, your experience with your professors, your experience with your supervisors. So as you're in this environment, you have all these other thought processes, all these other experiences, hopefully not impinging upon you, but informing you as you interact with the client, patient, or care seeker, what your words you might use to describe that environment. However, that holding environment itself is in an environment. That holding environment itself is in a container. And that's what I would like to talk to you in a short period of time, is the container, the holding environment, that your therapeutic holding environment is in. And that is, how do we understand worldviews? Because our worldviews have thoughts and experiences that impinge upon them. And how do we as professionals, and as I understand, and I would interpret this community, how do we understand as healers in a society that is problematic, that is toxic, that is psychologically does not offer people ways to health, that you will be the healers in this community in the future, and how do we understand worldviews in terms of that? How does your worldview that's going to hold your therapeutic container, how does your worldview impact? And I thought I would take a few minutes to travel 50,000 years to try to help us understand a worldview and how that has impacted history and how that comes and impacts us as individuals as we practice in 15 minutes. So, bear with me. Something happened in human history at a moment and at a time that's crucial to who we are as beings today. Somewhere, somehow, probably in East Central Africa, maybe it was 50,000 years ago, 60, 40, somebody, a man or a woman, was sitting, took a stick, and drew a circle in the dirt. And that circle in the dirt, to that person, for a first time, for a moment in time, represented the moon or the sun. For the first time, human beings engaged in the symbolic process of trying to figure out who they were on this planet. It is absolutely crucial for us to understand that as human beings, we are symbol-making creatures, and we use symbols to put together myths, and we use those myths to help us understand this world of who we are as people. And how we have those myths put together inside our minds will determine whether we're tolerant or intolerant. The difficulty with taking a symbol like the sun or the moon, and if we travel back again in time, I may take that symbol and put it on my axe, my spear, my pottery. When I do that, I make that object that I've put this symbol on an object of value. That object at that moment in time becomes a meaning-making object which attracts meaning in how I interpret where I am as a human being. For example, I used to be on a bowling team in the north, and duck pins. I don't know if you ever bowled with duck pins or smaller balls, and you use three of them. instead of two, it's in 10 pins. And a person on my team, we called him the hammer, because he would always throw the ball and he'd get 9 pins. But he got a spare every time. And he was the hammer. Right? Now, if you would have said something negative about the hammer, we would have had an attitude about it. Because that symbol was important. And it had meaning, and it attracted meaning around it. And it gave him extra power. And when he would stand up there to bowl, he would think of himself, I'm the hammer, and he would have more energy to get that spare. The same thing if I'm a hunter and I have a spear and I put the sun emblem on the spear, it becomes important to me because now I become a ray of the sun. And that spear is going to strike its target with the power of the sun. And as that begins to make meaning, we come to see the birth and the beginning of religion. So now, if somebody makes fun of the sun or the spear, they're making fun of my religion. They're making fun of my meaning-making process. They're making fun of an organizing principle to a community. And that's a problem when they do that. So the human being at this point can make meaning. We see something happening 30,000 years ago, to say, that out of East Central Africa, we see this path that moves up into the Pyrenees and moves into Siberia. And along this path, we've discovered statues. Venus statues. Statues of the mother. Statues of the dark mother. And some people are suggesting that because we have the same statue, and statues are now the object of value, which have meaning that's connected to them, that there may have been a universal belief system that traveled along this migration path. And that universal belief system had the qualities of transformation, cooperation, justice. Was there a worldview at that point with those characteristics? I'm going to say in a tolerant way, so because I could be wrong, yes. That I'm going to have in my worldview that piece of information. We have it around 12,000 years ago, the agrarian revolution, around 8,000 years ago, we see something different happening that's contrary to that value system. We see the formation of a patriarchal society where dominance, where slavery, where oppression, where the persecution of the other becomes a set of values. This could be the first world war of world of ideas. Now, how that might travel through time. What happens when you have these ideas? What happens when you have an idea of oppression that's bumping into an idea of cooperation and unification? You begin to see a fragmented process. And if you read back through time, there'll be different goddesses with different characteristics and different gods with different characteristics. And you will see in those different belief systems of those goddesses and gods the beliefs of cooperation, of transformation, but they really don't gain full power in the society anymore. They just don't. And for example of how that travels through time in a fragmented way, the goddess Maat, sister of Isis, what she would do at the end of death, there was a feather. And if you were lighter than the feather, you went to a good place. If you were not lighter than the feather, then that means guilt, something negative you have done made you heavy, and you didn't go to the good place. For example, here would be some of the determinations of lightness. I have not caused affliction. I have not caused pain. I have not made people to weep. I have not killed. I have not been an eavesdropper. I wasn't going to get into political conversation, but there it is. So 3,000 years ago, you have this ritual around death. I have not slain people. I have not spoken lies. But again, when you have a clash of ideas, you have a fragmentation, you have an oppression of language, because when you have, I have not told lies, I have not been involved in corruption, value system confronting another value system, the domination of the other value system suppresses knowledge. Knowledge gets on the margin. It's oppressive to it. 2,000 years later, we have in the speech of Samuel, in the Hebrew sacred text, 2,000 years later, we have these words. So we see that in the religious form at this particular point in religion, there's an effort to keep the value system from that first world order alive, where there are other value systems trying to oppress it. And what we have in the speech of Samuel, he was a judge in the nation of, in the tribal system of the Jewish people. They didn't have a king at this point, and there's a transition from a judge to a king, and some might say there's a transition from a more value system of cooperation and transformation to a patriarchal value system from the judge to the king. And so here in Samuel's farewell speech, he says these things. I have listened to everything you said to me, and I have given you a king, which the people wanted, which Samuel and God did not want for the people, but the people wanted it anyway. Now I give you your king as your leader. For me, I am old and gray. My sons are here with you. I have been your leader from my youth until this day. Here I stand to testify. Here I stand, testify against me in the presence of the Lord who has anointed me. And that's the same formula that we see with the goddess Maat. Testify against me at death if you can to determine if I'm light or if I'm heavy. Here's 2,000 years later, we see the same ritualistic formula. He says, whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? To whom have I cheated? Whom have I oppressed? For whom have I accepted a bribe? If I have done any of these things, I will make it right. What we see is the struggle for a value system trying to live in another community with a different value system, and it's problematic. A few hundred years later, well, before that, Assyria comes in, takes over the nation of Israel, not Judah, and then Assyria retracts. When the empire, Assyria, pulls back. And here's where we get into the intolerance that I think is important to understand in terms of religion. When Assyria withdraws, you have this value system of transformation and value system of justice that exists, and a value system of tolerance in the nation and in the community of Israel. When Assyria withdraws, you have a nationalistic movement that comes out. And in this nationalistic movement that comes out, it's also a religious nationalism. And what they do is they begin to say that the God Yahweh, and there are Elohim, El, different gods in, with this group of people, but the Yahweh as priests begin to take power. And they say they found a scroll that Moses have signed, that Moses signed, one of their leaders, which gives them power. They found the secret scroll. They've got the secret information, which gives them power. And they begin to, whereas they did not before in this nation, they begin to oppress foreign religions. They begin to oppress other religions. And in these other religions, temple prostitution, male and female, was part of the religious process. It was not against the law. It was a holy process. The practice of the rival worships are forbidden. Witchcrafts, sorcery, use of omens, worshiping images of gods of wood or stone, different expressions of festivals, temple rituals involving prostitution and homosexuality. Homosexuality is labeled an abomination. So here we see for the first time with this group of people, religious intolerance. And the point I want to make today before we get into the panel discussion is that religious intolerance, when it gets connected to a nationalistic movement, has the potential to become normal in a society, and we don't even know its religious intolerance. It wasn't until 1973 that homosexuality was declared not a mental illness. Homosexuality, according to science, medical science in our culture, was labeled a mental illness. Where do we first see homosexuality as a problem? 2,600 years ago. And it was a religious movement that named it as a problem. Now this nationalistic religious movement, 2,600 years later, was woven into the tapestry of Western civilization as if it's the norm. So when we talk about religious intolerance, we certainly could talk about the dominionists, the reconstructionists, they want to institute the Old Testament law, and some of the obvious things. But we also got to take a step back and talk about the tapestry and the unconscious tapestry that's in the society in which we live, and look at the origins of that, of those values of the society in which we live. And the only way to do that is to have a worldview that spans centuries and thousands of years to understand who we are as human beings. The narrower our worldview, the more we are unaware of how we form as cultures and as societies and as individuals. The larger our worldview, the 50,000-year worldview, understanding how we as human beings become symbol-making creatures and meaning-making creatures, when you're sitting with a person in your office, I think will assist you to be better healers. So I will conclude this part of it with this. As a Unitarian Universalist, 500 years ago, our founder, Michael Servetus, who challenged the view of the Trinity and said, he wrote a book called Wrongness of the Trinity, essentially, he was burned at the stake because he didn't agree with the Trinity. So I know that. Okay. And I know John Calvin was the instigator. Today, and that's a 500-year worldview, today we have religious groups saying, back to Calvin. Back to John Calvin, who was a theologian back at that time. As a Unitarian Universalist, when I hear back to John Calvin, knowing that the founder of my faith tradition was burned at the stake, I raise a red flag. But if I didn't know that history, I wouldn't know to raise that red flag. If I'm putting history, that 50,000 year, that 3,000 year history as part of my worldview, and I see that prostitution and homosexuality became ostracized and discriminated against as a religious movement, now how do I consider prostitution being illegal, homosexuality being an alienative process? I must understand it as religious intolerance. But yet, it becomes civil law. And that's the caution I'll leave you with at this point. Let us be careful not to allow religious intolerance to become civil law.